Well, thank you very much, Emily. And I have to say I'm a little overwhelmed by the number here. I wasn't expecting quite so many people. So good morning, and thank you to Bloomberg for having me here this morning. This is actually my first speech as Assistant Governor, Financial System, so I hope you'll be kind to me. I've not been involved in the financial stability area of the bank before. I was part of Financial System Group when it was first established in 1998. At that time, I was sitting in the payments policy area of the bank, which, as we'll see, also has financial stability responsibilities. So I thought this morning, reflecting my own recent journey here in trying to get my head around financial stability, I thought I'd have a little look back at how the bank's work in this area has evolved over the last 20 years, and particularly since the financial crisis. So I pose myself the question, has the way we look at financial stability changed since the global financial crisis? So I'm going to give you the answer right up front. I think at a big picture level, the way we look at it really hasn't changed all that much. But we are much more attuned to tail risks than we were. We're also much more attuned to the need to take action if we sense that risks are building. And we are, as are policymakers around the world, more sensitive to risk. But first of all, I wanted to give you a little bit of history of the Reserve Bank. So most of you will be familiar with the history of the Reserve Bank of Australia. Briefly, its genesis was in the Commonwealth Bank of Australia, which was established by legislation in 1911. In this early incarnation, the bank only had the ordinary functions of a commercial bank, commercial and savings bank. But over the succeeding years, it gradually took on a number of functions and activities that are typical of central banks. It was given control over the note issue in the 1920s, and then progressively it acquired exchange control powers, controls over the banking system. The bank's powers in relation to the administration of monetary and banking policy and exchange control were formalized in legislation in 1945. Then in 1959, the Commonwealth Bank was effectively split into two. The original institution, the original legislative institution, became the Reserve Bank of Australia, whose role was to carry out central banking functions, while the commercial and the savings bank functions were transferred to a new institution that kept the name the Commonwealth Bank of Australia. Why this brief history lesson? I thought it was worth highlighting upfront that the Reserve Bank has always had financial stability as one of its core functions. The focus on the activities of private banks and the ways in which they could be influenced or controlled grew out of the experiences of the Depression in the 1930s and the major banking crisis in Australia in the 1890s. Since its establishment as a standalone central bank, there have been two key changes to the way the Reserve Bank has approached its financial stability obligations. The first was in the early 1980s, when, following the financial system inquiry undertaken by the Campbell Committee, the Australian financial system was deregulated. Previously, banks had been heavily regulated, so they were limited in their ability to take risks. In the new deregulated environment, the Reserve Bank built up a banking supervision framework. Prudential standards were introduced, and the focus was on the risk management frameworks of the private banks. The second key change followed another financial system inquiry undertaken by the Wallace Committee. As a result of the inquiry, the banking supervision function was transferred to a new institution, the Australian Prudential Regulation Authority, or APRA, as you all know it. The Reserve Bank, however, retained a role focusing on, and I quote, "overall financial system stability." How did we interpret this? I think it was well set out in the bank's 1999 annual report, the first year of these new arrangements. The bank stated that, and this is again a quote, "its objective is to ensure that financial disturbances in any part of the financial system do not ultimately threaten the health of the economy." It went on to set out the foundations of financial stability: low inflation, a safe and robust payment system, efficient and smoothly functioning financial markets, and a sound framework of prudential supervision. Since then, we haven't changed the way we interpret our mandate for financial stability. I think that reflects it really well. We are somewhat more explicit about recognising the potential human cost of financial instability in terms of financial distress and unemployment. And we're more attuned to the behavioural risks associated with risk cultures and financial innovations. But we have substantially increased our communication on financial stability issues. For example, in 1999, when we first started reporting formally on financial stability, we published 10 pages in the annual report, of which about half were actually an assessment of financial stability. There were six charts. The charts were credit spreads in overseas bond markets, credit to GDP, credit growth, house prices, banks' impaired assets, and risk-weighted capital ratios. In March 1994, when we first published the Financial Stability Review, the standalone publication, the assessment was around 40 pages and there were over 40 charts. And it's now routinely between 50 and 60 pages with upwards of 60 charts. We give a lot more speeches covering financial stability issues, such as this one. But while we publish much more detailed analysis, the substance of the core issues has not changed substantially. The global financial environment was considered in the 1999 assessment, as was credit, household balance sheets, property prices, and the resilience of banks. So how, if at all, has the global financial crisis changed the way we look at financial stability? It hasn't fundamentally changed the way we think about financial system stability, though we now have a deeper understanding of the nature of the risks and the potential channels of contagion. We have also built significant capacity to better monitor risks, both in the banking and the non-bank sectors. Overall, I'd say that policymakers around the world have become more alert to system-wide risks. Prior to the GFC, there was a common, but not universal, view that the system was fairly stable. While there were some concerns about the growth in credit and asset prices, there were a number of plausible explanations suggesting that stability of the global financial system would continue. Among these were the long period of global macroeconomic stability and low inflation that was expected to continue, and also that low yields in that period were a natural consequence of the flow of savings from Asian economies. There were some alternative, more pessimistic views. They were centred around the view that investors were seriously underestimating risk and taking on too much leverage. But the more prevalent view seemed to be that the diversification of risk made possible by financial innovation and the relative strength of capital and liquidity levels would stand the system in good stead. You could say it had a bit of a "this time it's different" flavour. While we recognise these arguments, policymakers in Australia never entirely bought into this. The experience with losses in commercial property in the late 1980s, the collapse of HIH in 2001, and the housing boom of the early 2000s perhaps made Australian regulators a little more circumspect. APRA had therefore maintained a strong supervisory focus on Australian financial institutions. But we're also fortunate in Australia that the boom in commodity prices and the substantial rise in the terms of trade through the 2000s produced a very favourable economic environment at a time when many of the major economies were moving into recession. It was probably also fortuitous that there'd been a bit of a shakeout in the housing market in Australia in 2004-2005. So we weren't in a boom phase when the global financial crisis hit. All of these factors resulted in the Australian financial system coming out of the global financial crisis in relatively good shape. Post-global financial crisis, however, policymakers globally, including Australia, are more exercised about system-wide risk. I think this has resulted in three changes: more scrutiny of the global financial system, strengthened regulation, and a greater willingness to respond when risks appear to be rising. So talking a little about the scrutiny. One concrete outcome of this at the global level was the creation of the Financial Stability Board in 2009, the successor to the Financial Stability Forum. The Financial Stability Forum had been set up by the G7 finance ministers and central bank governors in 1999 to enhance international cooperation to promote stability in the international financial system. Australia was a member of the Financial Stability Forum. Following the global financial crisis, the G20 called for the Financial Stability Forum's membership to be broadened and its effectiveness to be strengthened. This resulted in the establishment of the Financial Stability Board, with a broader membership and mandate. Specifically, the Financial Stability Board was to promote international financial stability by coordinating national financial authorities and international standard-setting bodies as they work toward developing strong regulatory, supervisory and other financial sector policies. It's a mouthful, but it involved assessing vulnerabilities affecting the global financial system and proposing actions to address them, promoting implementation of financial sector regulation and policies, and monitoring implementation of the agreed reforms. This agenda has taken the FSB into such areas as supervision, resolution regimes for banks and for central counterparties, derivatives markets, shadow banking, compensation practices, data and disclosure, and of course legal and accounting issues. And the Financial Stability Board is actively looking for the next potential source of systemic risk. At its most recent meeting, for example, it considered issues raised by fintech, misconduct and climate-related financial exposures. On the regulatory side, the international standard-setting bodies looked to lessons learnt from the crisis and in some cases revised their standards. The Basel Committee on Banking Supervision introduced a significantly strengthened capital and liquidity framework for banks, with additional requirements for the global systemically important banks, or G-SIBs. Minimum capital levels were increased, capital buffers were incorporated, and leverage ratios and liquidity requirements were introduced. Disclosure requirements in banking and financial markets increased. Australia has followed this international move. APRA has increased capital requirements, has applied the liquidity coverage ratio from 2015, and the net stable funding ratio will commence in 2018. And this applies to larger and more complex authorised deposit-taking institutions in Australia. APRA is now working on implementing the recommendation of yet another financial system inquiry, undertaken by David Murray, that Australian banks' capital ratios should be unquestionably strong. Standards covering financial market infrastructure were also strengthened and supervisory oversight was increased. Central counterparties and security settlement systems generally performed pretty well during the global financial crisis. Central counterparties in particular withstood the default of Lehman Brothers, although the complete resolution was complicated and did take some time. This resulted in increasing regulatory pressure for securities and derivatives to be cleared through central counterparties, making them even more systemically important. Regulatory oversight increased along with this increase in importance, with attention focused on risk management and loss absorbance capabilities of central counterparties, recovery plans and resolution in the event that the central counterparty was unable to recover. International work in this area is ongoing, with the Financial Stability Board releasing a consultation paper on central counterparty resolution in February. As overseer of the stability of central counterparties in Australia, the Reserve Bank has been applying these new standards to domestically operating central counterparties, the most prominent ones being the ASX central counterparties for equities and derivatives. Finally, there seems to be more willingness for regulators and policymakers to take action if they see risk building. Prior to the global financial crisis, there was a school of thought that because asset bubbles could not be detected in advance, it was better to clean up after any bust rather than lean against the cycle with policy. This was not the only view, however, and some policymakers had argued for a number of years that there were indicators that could be used to detect financial imbalances and that in some circumstances policy settings should be set to take into account these imbalances. Post-global financial crisis, there has been some swing towards this latter view, not universal, but some swing. There's now more acceptance of the need to take action when system-wide risks are rising. This is reflected in the increasing use of what are commonly known as macroprudential policies. As my colleagues David Orsman and Fiona Price wrote in a bulletin article in December 2016, there is no universally accepted definition of macroprudential policy. They define it as the use of prudential actions to contain risks that, if realised, could have widespread implications for the financial system as a whole, as well as the real economy. They also note that the use of such tools has increased in a number of countries post-global financial crisis. In Australia, we see macroprudential policy as part and parcel of the financial stability framework. As we've set out on a number of other occasions, the essence of macroprudential policy is that prudential supervisors recognise the potential system-wide risks in their supervision of individual institutions and react accordingly. APRA can and does take an active supervisory stance, modifying the intensity of its prudential supervision as it sees fit to address institution-specific risks, sectoral risks, or overall systemic risk. A recent example might help to illustrate this. In 2014, the Australian regulators took the view that risks were building in the residential housing market that warranted attention. There was very strong demand for residential housing loans, particularly by investors. Price competition in the mortgage market had intensified, and discounts on advertised variable rates were common. There also seemed to be a relaxation in non-price lending terms. The share of new loans that were interest-only was drifting up, and the growth of lending for investment properties was accelerating. Unsurprisingly, in this environment, growth in housing prices was strong, particularly in Melbourne and Sydney. The regulators judged that more targeted action was needed to address these risks, to put a bit of sand in the gears, if you like. So APRA tightened a number of aspects of its supervision. It indicated that it would be alert to annual growth in a bank's investor housing lending above a benchmark of 10%. It also set some more prescriptive guidelines for serviceability assessments and intensified its scrutiny of lending practices. ASIC also undertook a review of lending with a focus on whether lenders were complying with responsible lending obligations. There's no doubt that the actions did address some of the risks. Nevertheless, the early experience suggests that while the resilience of both borrowers and lenders have no doubt improved, the initial effects on credit and some of the other indicators we use to assess risk may fade over time. We are continuing to monitor their ongoing effects and are prepared to do more if needed. Where to from here? With the GFC close to 10 years ago now, hard to believe really, isn't it? A substantial amount of regulatory reform has been undertaken, and the focus is turning to implementation and taking stock of the effectiveness of the reforms. This is reflected in the Financial Stability Board's current agenda. But there's also some thinking to be done about how monetary policy considerations should factor into financial stability issues, and the role that macroprudential policies might play in addressing system-wide risks in a low interest rate environment. So in conclusion, I would like to return to the question that I posed at the beginning of this talk, and in fact the question I posed myself when I first came into this area a few months ago. Has the way we look at financial stability changed since the global financial crisis? While the basic way we look at financial stability has not changed, experience with the global financial crisis reinforced the need to focus on system-wide issues not just individual institutions. We need to spend time analysing them and thinking about whether policy responses might be required. We're still learning how best to do this. Thank you.
Michelle, it's so wonderful to have you here for our first Bloomberg address of 2017. Before I dig deeper into the content of your speech, I mean, you've had some time to settle into your new role, get a little bit of perspective. What are your top priorities in your new role?
So my new role incorporates just both financial stability and payments policy. I have a bit of a background in payments, so I'm not coming to that from a blank sheet of paper. I think my priorities are probably twofold. On the financial stability side, I think, as I mentioned in my talk, I think one of the things that we are still trying to improve at is understanding how best to respond when we see risks rising in a financial stability sense. And I think there's more work to do here. I think active supervision by APRA and ASIC in their space is very important in these areas. But we need to understand a little bit more about the interactions of these sorts of policies on ultimately the things we're driving at. We're not aiming at some of the indicators. It's not credit we're aiming at, or it's not housing prices we're aiming at. We're interested in resilience of financial institutions and resilience of household balance sheets. And so we need to dig deeper into analysing the impact that these sorts of policies have on those. On the payments side, I'll just put in a bit of a plug. I think the main thing that I'm getting focused on there is the introduction of the new payments platform later this year, and I think that's going to be a very exciting development for Australia. So they're sort of the two things I think I'm focusing on in my new role.
I want to pick up on what you said, because you say that the focus, the target, is not housing prices or leverage growth, but you know, these are really the key concerns for a lot of investors, and you know, for most Australians, it's almost a bit of a national obsession. Housing prices, 18% growth in Sydney to date, fastest in 14 years. How concerned are you that this is a very fast-growing systemic risk?
Again, these are indicators that there might be risks being taken on that are not, that in the event of a downturn might result in systemic issues for the banking system. I think the what individual banks do might look okay, but when you group all the banks together as a system, sometimes all of them doing a similar thing can have a very dramatic effect. So what we're really focusing on is, to what extent are things like the growth in house prices, the growth in debt, what are they signalling about whether or not households have balance sheets that can withstand perhaps a downturn, whether it be due to unemployment, whether it's due to a downturn in the economy for some reason. Will households be able to withstand, their balance sheets be able to withstand that? And I think the other issue we worry about is, in a systemic sense, is to what extent is there pro-cyclicality in the prices of these things? So is there evidence that people are seeing prices rise and they think prices will always rise, and so they are chasing the prices? If that happens, then what happens if things turn down? Will the slump be much bigger than it will otherwise be? So we're focused on whether or not these things might be pro-cyclical and whether or not there are implications for the resilience of household balance sheets and banking balance sheets as well.
Yeah, we had the Treasurer on yesterday on Daybreak Australia, on Bloomberg, and he was saying how, look, the prices are high, but they're real. This is not a speculative asset bubble that we're looking at here. It's an issue of supply and demand. Do you agree with that to a full extent?
I wouldn't like to predict bubbles or not. What I would say is that we are looking to make sure that in lending practices, banks are not overextending themselves, not taking risks that in the event of a downturn would render them underwater, or that households would do the same thing. So I wouldn't like to speculate on what's a bubble and what's not, personally.
I want to go back to what you said, one of the things you mentioned in your speech, that over time, the impact, the effectiveness of macroprudential measures tend to fade. To what extent have you seen that happen? Is that happening now?
Well, I guess this is where we need to do some more work. Certainly the indicators, so when we first introduced in 2014, when APRA first started its more focused supervision, and the 10% benchmark, which I think everyone's probably aware of, was out there in terms of investor housing. Initially, it dropped back below that, and so the indicators suggested it had been effective. I think everyone would be aware that more recently, investor housing growth has started to speed up again. I think the Governor has highlighted that as something to watch. Certainly in terms of financial stability perspective, we are watching it because investors can be the first ones to get out if things turn down, which could add to pro-cyclicality concerns. So we are watching this carefully. And I think it's worth saying, though, that the initial reactions to this by APRA have put the financial institutions and households in a much stronger position in terms of their resilience. The proportion of loans that are high loan devaluation ratios have fallen, and I think generally there's much more resilience in both those balance sheets. So it's been positive. We're seeing things pick up again, and that's why we're watching it very carefully and considering whether we might need to do more.
You also mentioned the consideration given to the role of monetary policy settings in managing risks, particularly in a low-rate environment that we have been in. I mean, does that infer more of a willingness to straight out raise rates, even though we have a low-inflation environment, to try and contain these risks?
The monetary policy has got one instrument, and that's the interest rate. Although I'm not in the area of monetary policy, when the Governor talks about monetary policy, I think he put it very well, actually, in one of his recent speeches. It might have been the talk to the Parliamentary Committee. He noted that there is a balance. There's an interest rate that needs to support the economy and support economic growth. But on the other hand, they've got to be alert to whether or not low interest rates might be fueling borrowing and investing, and whether or not that might be introducing risks to the financial sector. So it's a balance. And in setting monetary policy, I know that these are the sorts of issues that are on the mind of the Governor and the Board.
How much would prices need to rise in the property market for a move to be taken on the interest rate?
I wouldn't even hesitate to suggest anything.
I had to ask.
I know you had to ask.
The Treasurer yesterday said that he did meet with the Financial Stability Council. Were further macroprudential measures on the table, and what would they look like?
The Council of Financial Regulators meets quarterly, but actually we talk much more frequently than that across the agencies. So the Council of Financial Regulators is the Reserve Bank, APRA, ASIC, Australian Securities and Investments Commission, and Treasury. So we meet quarterly. We talk very, very regularly about all sorts of things.
Was that a quarterly meeting, or was that a...
Quarterly meeting. One thing that's always on the table is discussion about what are the risks, what are the tail risks, what are the financial stability risks. So macroprudential policies, if you like, are always on the table. Are there things that APRA can be doing? What is APRA seeing about the risks that individual financial institutions are taking? What is it seeing in its thematic reviews? You will have seen recently they released a thematic review of commercial property. So they're always looking at risks and looking at whether there are ways they need to tighten their supervision in some way, depending on those risks. So it's always on the table.
We spoke earlier, just before your speech, about having the sort of joint perspective of coming from the country but being based in Sydney for quite some time. You know, you have a situation where prices in Melbourne and Sydney are just roaring. There are cities like Perth and smaller cities where prices are falling quite dramatically. What are the challenges of setting one policy for such a 2-3-speed economy that we have, particularly when it comes to housing prices?
It's a good point you raise. The experience is very different across the country. And it's also a little bit different in apartment and detached housing prices as well. So monetary policy only has one interest rate, so it has to set for what it thinks is best for the economy, and the governor and the board obviously consider that on a monthly basis. In terms of financial stability, I think APRA, again, has the ability to get financial institutions to look perhaps more, a little more on a regional basis. So this, again, is all about the institutions understanding where their risks lie, understanding whether or not there are oversupplies in particular areas or undersupplies. So I think financial institutions increasingly are doing this. They are taking into account these sort of differences in regions and understanding what that might mean for the risks they're taking on in lending in those regions.
You know, it's interesting. You mentioned the difference between different types of housing. High-rise apartments has been a bit of a bugbear for the RBA. They've consistently mentioned it in the stability reports. Is that something that you're concerned about, that even though new starts have pulled back, that there's going to be a pretty steady supply coming on stream soon?
The thing we've highlighted in the financial stability reviews recently has been the looming oversupply in Brisbane in particular, and possibly in some parts of Melbourne. Not so much Sydney, it doesn't seem to be as big an issue. The concern there is about the resilience of the financial institutions. It's about whether or not the financial institutions are adequately provisioned, their lending standards have been adequate, and that if there is an oversupply and a fall in prices, that the financial institutions don't end up underwater or wearing larger losses than they expect because they hadn't anticipated this. So the focus really, again, is very much on how does this translate into the resilience of the financial institutions and possibly the resilience of the households. Have households purchased these apartments on the expectations of rents and rising prices, and in fact with a glut they may not be able to rent them out and they may not get the price they paid for them. So again, it's all focused on whether or not the resilience of the balance sheets will hold up if these markets turn down.
The Chinese capital control story has, as most people probably know, have played out in a variety of ways, but we saw that kind of really send shockwaves through the new build sector. Do you have any insight into how settlements have been proceeding? Do we have sort of data into that?
We don't have a lot of data on that. My understanding is that we aren't seeing a particular uptick in failed settlements at this stage, but that will be things to watch, and liaison will also help us get a handle on those sorts of things.
How vulnerable is Australia to these regulatory developments in China?
I think China is an interesting situation in that there's two possible ways, I suppose, that things could flow from China to Australia. The first is a downturn in China, which leads to a downturn in economic conditions in Australia through a commodity price style. Now, there'll be a lot of other things happen in those circumstances, but again, that takes you back. It doesn't matter where the shock comes from. Are the banks resilient enough? Are the households resilient enough to wear it if the economy turns down? So there's that sort of mechanism. The other sort of mechanism is whether or not, and I think this might be what you're referring to, is the extent to which financial institutions might be exposed to Chinese interests. I don't think we have any really good data on that, but really, I think what's driving the property market and lending in Australia for housing and so on is really it's mainly domestic. It's foreign is not the main source of this. It's part of it, but it's not the whole story.
I mean, for an expert on financial stability, China is a fascinating case study, isn't it, right now? I mean, if you were to look globally, what comparisons, I guess, what lessons would you take from some of these other markets that have been through similar cycles, you know, Hong Kong, Singapore, New Zealand, closer by?
Yeah, and I think they're all experimenting with their own sort of brands of macroprudential policies. New Zealand's got a particular, but they all have slightly different concerns. And the way the markets are set up in various countries also matters an awful lot. Some countries don't have a lot of interest-only lending, some do. Some have sort of... Australia, for example, a very big feature of Australian household borrowing is that buffers offset accounts. This isn't actually a really big feature in many other countries. So I think it's hard to draw specific lessons from overseas because everyone's institutional background is slightly different. Everyone's cultural background is slightly different. There's different attitudes to housing and different attitudes to owner-occupied versus renting. So I think it's very difficult to draw specific lessons. You can draw general lessons, I think, about, well, look, here's some ways that prudential policy might be able to address risks. But I think if you just pick a particular policy from a particular country, it won't necessarily work.
On the topic of regulation broadly, I mean, what implications are there for Australia, given that you do have President Trump in the process of dismantling as yet unspecified parts of Dodd-Frank? What do you see as being, you know, the knock-on effects to the global banking system?
Well, let me say right up front that I don't know exactly where this is going to go, and I wouldn't like to predict where it's going to go. The things I have heard mentioned are things like the Volcker Rule, which isn't applicable to Australia and a lot of other countries, regulations on small and medium banks, consumer protection agencies and their powers. So the things that sort of are floating around, and again, we have no specifics, so it's hard to know, but the things that are floating around tend to be more US-specific. The capital framework that is being finalised at the moment and the liquidity framework, I don't think that that's going to impact the way we in Australia think about this. And certainly, if you listen to Stefan Ingves, who's the chair of the Basel Committee is continuing to push forward to try and get it finalised, the Basel III agreement. So there's an expectation that these things will continue to be implemented.
Is there any case for alarm that this is sort of starting a trend towards global deregulation, or at least as part of this, you know, populist movement that we've seen?
I think the way I would look at it is that there's a pause at the moment. We're actually done an awful lot of regulation recently been introduced. The focus now, I think, as I said in my speech, is focusing on implementation, getting everything bedded down, and then looking at the effectiveness of reforms. And that's one of the big things that the Financial Stability Board has on its agenda. It wants to take a step back and say, OK, we've done all this now. How can we look at whether or not it's had the intended effects and has it been effective for us? So I think that's where things will go for the time being. So I'm not particularly pessimistic on that aspect. No.
There's some concern that Basel won't get done. I mean, what are the consequences if that happens or doesn't happen?
Well, as far as I can tell, from what I've seen, it's the intention of everyone is to get it done.
Just before we wrap up, I mean, are there any other emerging, I don't want to say black swan, because obviously last year was the year that black swans weren't really black swans, but are there any other emerging risks that you think aren't getting enough attention at the moment?
No, I think we've talked about most of them. I guess all I could say is that something will come from left field that no one was expecting. That's probably... but really, I think at the moment, we feel in Australia that we're in a pretty comfortable position. We think that APRA is focusing on the right things, that the financial institutions are resilient, that they are much improved in their capital and liquidity positions. And, of course, APRA has yet to release its interpretation of what unquestionably strong is, and they'll be working on that, I gather, over the next year. And so I think that again, will be assisting us in making sure that wherever the shocks come from, that the resilience of the households and the banking sector will hold up. It's not saying there won't be any losses. It's not saying there's going to be no risks. That's not what we're talking about. but we're saying that there won't be, back to the concept of financial stability, that if there is some sort of shakeout, that these financial conditions won't dramatically affect the health of the economy, like obviously the global financial crisis.
Is shadow banking something that you're watching at the moment?
Shadow banking, in Australia, we're obviously looking at it, but in Australia most of the intermediation is still done through the supervised sector. Shadow banking is not a big issue in Australia. It's a much bigger issue in places like China. But in Australia, shadow banking is not a big issue at the moment. It's an issue we have to watch because if we are sort of increasing regulatory scrutiny on the supervised sector, and that's helping to, and that's sort of dampening their lending practice and so on, we have to make sure that there's not a great deal of leakage. But at the moment, there is no indication that there's a great deal of leakage to unsupervised institutions.
And just before I throw it out to the room, I'm personally curious, what's really surprised you the most since you took on this role?
I think what surprised me the most, because I wasn't aware of it, was the extent to which APRA has increased its regulatory supervision and scrutiny in the past 10 years. I think they always were quite hands-on, but being out of the area for sort of 6 to 10 years and coming back in, I've been really interested to see the extent to which they are heavily interested in what's going on. They are doing thematic reviews. They are. I think the other thing that's I've found quite interesting since I came back into this area is the focus on risk culture. And APRA's done a nice little piece on risk culture fairly recently. It's a very esoteric area in a sense, very qualitative, it's very difficult to measure, but that's an area that's getting increasing focus.
I think we should throw it out to questions from the room. I think there's a couple here.
Following on from your last question, from a macroprudential standpoint, do you see the rise of shadow banking as a net positive or negative for the system as a whole?
I think we would be concerned if there was a large shadow banking sector that was not subject to regulatory oversight. I think that would be our main issue. At the moment, that's not an issue because it's a very small part of the lending story, but as I hope I sort of described, part of the way we think about system stability is we look at individual institutions, but sometimes the whole comes to more than the parts. So what might not look risky for one institution, if all institutions are doing it, can become quite risky to the system as a whole. So there might be some benefits at the margin for sort of non-standard lenders, but I think probably the benefits of financial stability are better if there's an overseen core that is that's the substantial part of the lending activity, because that's where we can make sure that the system as a whole is not throwing up substantial risks.
Sorry, Paul Wiley. There's obviously a cost to financial stability, and that's not really part of your mandate. Do you care about it at all, or how do you deal with that? And then the second question is, looking at the experience of Europe, where they tend to bail out their banks, the US, where they've had thousands of small savings and loans institutions that go bust, in Australia we've got actually a very small number of institutions. Are they too big to fail?
First on the cost, yes, I think if cost was no object, if we didn't care, then there would be no risk. We'd just let no one take any risks. And clearly that would be massive costs because no intermediation would get done, no risk would get taken. What we're focusing on in financial stability is trying to make sure that in taking risks, that they are educated risks, and that if things go wrong, which inevitably they do with risks, sometimes things go wrong, it's not going to bring down the financial system and the economy. So that's so I wouldn't say we don't take into account costs, because if we did, clearly we'd just stamp everything down and we'd be back in a highly regulated environment that we used to be in the 1970s. Having said that, I think one of the things that the Financial Stability Board, in thinking about its effectiveness, it will be looking at issues like what are the benefits and what are the costs of this whole new system of regulation. Your second question on too big to fail. APRA has already indicated that the big four banks are in fact what it calls domestically systemically important banks. Part of the new Basel sort of arrangements is to try and move away from this too big to fail process by ensuring banks have enough loss-absorbing capacity, the total loss-absorbing capacity, in order to withstand basically runs, so that they can basically recapitalise themselves and the taxpayer doesn't have to throw in any money. That whole regime is there's a regime for the global systemically important banks, and the whole purpose of that is to try and make sure that it's the banks can recapitalise themselves without the input from taxpayers. APRA has indicated that they are looking at that issue in the Australian context. They've not said what they'll do yet, but if they do, that's exactly the same sort of rationale that they'll be using. How do we make sure that they can absorb the losses themselves, recapitalise themselves in the event they need to, without need for recourse to? Because I think one of the issues that was identified through the global financial crisis was this issue of too big to fail, and the moral hazard, obviously, that goes with that, that investors don't properly price the risk because they think that the government will bail it out. So we're yet to see the outcome of all those processes, but it's right at top of mind, I think.
Good morning. Paul Rintoul from Origin Capital.
My question is quite simple. One side of the balance sheet's being addressed in the sense that capital provisions are being improved. But the other side of the balance sheet, the quality of the credits themselves, are an interesting thing. They change through time. I've been in a number of institutions seeing them take more risk. Hmm. That happens as an internal decision, and it can happen across a number of banks simultaneously. Hmm. How do you keep track of the credit quality of the assets by class and by industry?
Well, first thing to say is that it's APRA that has the power to look at individual financial institutions. we do share information with APRA, obviously. And one of the things that APRA has been focusing on fairly recently, and popped out, I think, in the letter to banks after the commercial property thematic review, was that the theme of that seemed to me to be that the banks' data systems could be better in helping to keep. So, the answer to the question is we do it by talking to the banks, but there's another step there is how well do the banks understand their credit quality, and particularly credit quality over portfolios of things. And I think the flavour of APRA's recent pronouncements on this is that the banks need to perhaps do a little bit more work in this area, because I think they feel that APRA feels that the banks don't have as good a handle on some of the credit quality at an aggregate level, because as you say, I mean, it changes over time, and also, you know, how's the left arm know what the right arm's doing? So that's the way we do it, but it depends on the banks, in fact, having a good handle on it, and that I think is something that.
I'll just follow that up. Has there ever been consideration of risk audits since the taxpayer actually provides the last buck, the backstop. Has there been consideration of public risk audits of these support institutions?
What do you mean by a public risk audit? Sorry, I'm...
Exactly what the banks should be doing, namely going into their portfolios and understanding what a certain movement in price of a particular asset will do in terms of their failure rates.
And there is a little bit of that work. APRA does that sort of work in its stress testing environment. So what it will do is it will give a scenario to the banks. It might be an economic scenario with implications for prices and credit quality and those sorts of things. And it says to the banks, you show us what happens to your capital and liquidity when this hits you. So there is some stress testing that goes on, and I think it continues to do that. It does it
in the systematic picture.
Yeah, and what we do is we use that to try and get a picture of what would happen if all of these banks, and particularly if they're correlated,
yeah,
what would happen. So yes, we are doing that work. We do that work, and APRA assists us in doing that work as well.
Hi, Adrian Bloom, Bank of America Merrill Lynch. You mentioned fintech in the beginning, and conscious of your payments background, what's the bank's view in terms of its approach to the fintech space and the potential implications of that?
Sure. The first point I'd make, which was made by a colleague of mine, I don't claim this, is that fintech it's a bit unfortunate for a name because it covers so much stuff. Some people, when they talk about fintech, sort of mean payments, people coming into the payment space. Some mean peer-to-peer lending. It just depends on what they're talking about. In the payment space, I think there is quite a bit of debate about this at the moment. The issue that seems to be most on people's minds is access to data, and that's the issue that's obviously taken a lot of attention in Europe and the UK. And the Productivity Commission's working on that here. I think there's opportunities for fintech to contribute in this area here. I think it's very early days, though. I mean, I know everyone's quite excited about it and so on, but I still think it's quite early days. And if I put the financial stability filter on it, which is sometimes what people... I think at the moment it's far too small. I think our focus at the moment really in terms of the regulatory space is making sure that regulations don't stand in the way of fintech developments, and that at least in these early days the issues really are not about financial stability. They're probably more about consumer protection and those sorts of issues. So, because it's quite small, but nevertheless... I think all the agencies, and I know the government, everyone wants to make sure that regulation doesn't stand in the way of what might be quite innovative developments in whatever area of fintech you happen to be talking about.
Robert Rennie from Westpac. Excellent first speech. Congratulations, right on the mark. We definitely want to see more of that. In the March statement, Governor Lowe noted that supervisory measures have contributed to some strengthening of lending standards. In the February statement, he mentioned that they have strengthened.
Mm-hmm.
That implies a bit of a deterioration. Can you quantify that? And is there a sense of inevitability that macro or micro controls are probably coming?
I wouldn't read into it that they've weakened. What's happening is that there are various forces which housing lending is a big staple of the financial institutions. There's obviously a high demand for it. I think the actions that were taken in 2014 have strengthened the resilience of both the banks and the households because the serviceability standards have attempted to make sure that people won't be badly caught out by rises in interest rates, because the serviceability standards have required banks to put in a buffer on the interest rates. So I think those sorts of things have improved the resilience. I think the question is whether or not there might need more might need to be done. Are there signs that, notwithstanding that increased resilience, that competition is continuing to encourage lending and that the demand for lending still remains very high? And there might be a variety of underlying reasons for that that we can't necessarily impact, but we can make sure that in making lending decisions that the banks as a whole are not lowering the lending standards. So they haven't been lowered. They have had an impact on resilience, but it doesn't mean that we shouldn't look more at it and make sure that they're continuing to be prudent.
Ross Greenwood from the Nine Network. Can I just ask you a comment around 10 days ago on the OECD's report into Australia where it addressed financial stability and also the housing markets? It warned of a rout and also said a continued rise of the market fuelled by both investor and owner-occupier demand may end in a significant downward correction that spreads to the rest of the economy. Does the Reserve Bank share that risk as well?
I think as I've tried to sort of set out here, we are aware of the risks that maybe housing will turn down. But the point here is really about the impact of that on the household balance sheets and the financial system, financial sector spread, balance sheets. The worrying thing and the thing that happened in the United States was the issue of a big downturn in housing prices and resultant negative equity and big issues there. Hopefully, by what we've done with strengthening the resilience of the households and the banks to that is that with a downturn, they can withstand that sort of thing if that happened. Stepping back, though, of course, as Heidi already mentioned, it's actually very different across the countries. Different cities are experiencing different things at the moment. Western Australia, Brisbane, different to Melbourne and Sydney. So we are aware of it. We are watching it. If we need to take some additional macro-prudential actions to address what appear to be rising, rising pressures again, then that's something that we will look at.
Carrington Clark from the ABC, Assistant Governor, can I ask you to use a comparison with what we saw in the United States, but also Portugal and Ireland? When should the regulators have gotten involved, do you think, with the benefit of hindsight? And what are the factors that you're looking for to see whether or not Australia is approaching that bubble territory? I know you don't want to call it that, but what are the factors you're looking at and why are you currently so concerned?
well, I have no particular advice to offer regulators of the other countries on what they should have done in hindsight. As I said in the speech, I think what we have focused on is that it's not enough just to look at individual institutions. You have to look at the system. And as I hope I've sort of managed to convey, if all institutions are doing a similar thing, they might think they're being prudent, but if everyone's doing the same thing, it might mean that for the system as a whole, it's actually not very prudent. So what we are attempting to do is to make sure that the system as a whole, if we aggregate up what everyone is doing, that generates an outcome that doesn't result in a massive impact on the real economy from perhaps a downturn in asset prices. And the way we've been attempting to do that is by making sure that, as far as possible, the financial institutions are resilient, so if there's a downturn in asset prices, they don't find themselves underwater, and that the households don't find themselves in a situation where they have to emergency sell or whatever because they can't afford it anymore. And that means that households have to have enough equity in their homes, and it means that the financial institutions have to be prudent in terms of loan-to-valuation ratios and those sorts of things. So I think that what we saw from the GFC, although, as I said, the Australian financial system came out of the GFC in a pretty good place, it's made us more focused on the fact that just because one institution doesn't look to be doing anything particularly risky doesn't mean that if you don't aggregate it with everyone else that the end result isn't something that looks quite risky. And that's why we're focusing on making sure that lending standards are such that if there is a downturn, that it doesn't bring down a financial institution or a substantial proportion of households.